Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast with me, your host today, Sam Harris. On this show, we believe anyone can achieve their dreams. We break down things like what it takes to lead explosive tech businesses, to being paid to travel the world. Basically, I find amazing individuals doing cool things and share my insights. Hello, people. I hope you're ready for another episode of Awesomeness. Today, we're back in the world of tech startup, and I hope you have some note-taking equipment because there's so much to learn from our guest today. In fact, my own notes, I missed half of the lessons to be learned, and it was only listening back again many months later that I feel I actually took on board what I was being told. I don't know if any of you guys and girls have this sort of effect with music, but like sometimes you can have a song that you listen to a lot and like it's good, you sing the words and things. Then one day you'll be in like the right frame of mind or like listening deeper and suddenly you'll hear all the words and you'll realize there's like a whole deeper meaning to the entire song or some great like one-liner jokes that you just completely missed before. And I mean, maybe this happens more with rap where you often miss half the words anyway, but I feel like this happened to me with this podcast. And so I'll give you a deeper breakdown afterwards of the things I learned because yeah, really good. Anyway, my guest today is Nick Miller, the CEO of BuzzHire, an on-demand staffing agency for the hospitality industry. They basically smooth out staffing issues by providing people sort of within the hour if you need to help get people to help with your catering or run all your deliveries and things. And it's really cool. And equally, if you want like a job on demand, you can have a job through an app and it's kind of convenient. Anyway, for a young guy, he has a lot of experience. He has ran several businesses across the world, working for himself and for the infamous startup factory Rocket Internet. For a bit of a background, Nick employed me in my first ever job as a programmer, where I worked on the front end of the BuzzHire web app before I then left to start my own dev agency. I perhaps left a little bit earlier than might be normally acceptable, but I did still manage to leave on good terms somehow, and I'm pleased to still call him a friend, despite maybe letting him down a little bit. So anyway, during building BuzzHire, he's made a lot of hard decisions and taken on some really big risks, which he was actually very transparent about, communicating that. He was very transparent about communicating these decisions to the team, and I'm pleased to say he was happy to share this on the podcast. So anyone interested in fundraising will really appreciate this episode, as well as anyone that just likes a good story, of which he has some really good ones. On a note about funding for a startup, before we actually started recording, we were talking about the fact that I'm going to Asia with my company Automorph. And in general, he does advise that the appetite in Asia is really good. Investors are quite ready to fund good ideas that have come from overseas. So if you are thinking about where to start your startup, he does say that Asia is a good place to do it. And anyway, that's enough of me talking.
Hi, Nick. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Can you quickly introduce yourself?
So I'm currently the founder of a company called BuzzHire. We've been operating for the last couple of years out of London. Before that, I ran a company called Eat First, which was a food delivery business, delivering healthy food around London in 15 minutes. That was part of Rocket Internet. And I've been part of Rocket Internet for 4.5 years, more or less. Before Eat First, I launched the largest e-commerce platform for Africa, which is called Jumia. I was in charge of the East African operation and built out a team from scratch up to 120 people in 18 months. Very exciting. And then before that, I helped Rocket Internet out with a couple fashion e-commerce platforms out in Southeast Asia, so both in Vietnam and in Taiwan. And previous to joining Rocket, I was P&G, Procter & Gamble, as a finance analyst, both in manufacturing and in sales. And I'd done a bunch of stuff in financial services as an intern before that. But now running a 16-man startup, which is focusing on the workforce management and temp staffing and leveraging technology to improve that.
Cool. That's to the point. Saves me from asking all the previous things. Nice. So you always thought you were going to be an entrepreneur then, sounds like.
So I think from a very young age, I did a lot of entrepreneurial things. And because I think my father had a huge influence in me becoming an entrepreneur. So lots of little things, like whenever he wanted to sell his car, I'd be in charge of selling the car. If I made a profit versus the dealer, I'd keep the profit, which when you're 12 years old or 13 years old can make a big difference. Yeah, lots of different things. So I was doing that when I was 12 and then 15 again, whenever we sold a car. And then when I was still at school, I was putting on events and making a profit out of that, and I actually continued doing that for many years. But the best profit I ever made was when I was 17. So
what was that?
I put on an event in a famous club in London and invited actually a bunch of underage people, because we were all underage, and charged quite a lot of money at the door, and had a pretty budget DJ, and made, I think first night we made, it was myself and I was running it and a friend helped me to promote it, but we made £5,000 in cash as profit on one night, which is pretty good.
That's pretty impressive for 17.
Yeah, it's once you get success like that, you realize actually it's not as hard as you might have thought, and it gives you the confidence to do a lot more. But then you also realize that a one-off is much easier than a consistent kind of business. Yeah.
Getting all the staff and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. So can we go a bit more into BuzzHire now, what you're doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically BuzzHire came about because I was really interested in the on-demand space. This was about 3.5-4 years ago. Lots of different businesses coming out trying to supply goods or services on demand, like Deliveroo and QuickUp and Gin, which were delivering things all over on demand. And Eat First, which was part of Rocket Internet, was trying to deliver healthy food all around London in 15 minutes. And I really loved the customer value, customer proposition of that business. And that's why I agreed to launch it. I agreed to join the Rocket Venture and launch the business. And then I quickly realized that essentially, whether it's a tech on-demand business or not, every business is becoming on-demand. Customers expect goods and services to be delivered to them immediately. And that's kind of a recurring theme across multiple sectors. And the biggest constraint for a lot of these businesses being able to manage their staff and flex that up and down as their customers' demand increases or subsides. So we at Eat First constantly had the problem on a very real basis of making sure that we had enough drivers to deliver the food and enough people in the kitchen to make the food. And there would be some days where we had a lot more demand and other days where we had a lot shorter. And so how to manage that was really the main constraint and the main key to delivering great customer experience. And we were working with agencies in the kitchen that were really providing a pretty poor service in terms of the cost they were charging us, the quality of the people and how reliable they were. And so I realized there was a huge opportunity in building a tech platform that facilitates that whole problem and brings down cost, makes it more transparent, more convenient, quicker. And so we launched back in 2015, about this time, 2 years ago, and focused at the beginning on the logistics sector because I knew that there was a lot of new companies trying to disrupt last mile delivery, obviously Deliveroo and Uber Eats and lots of others. And the constraints that we were feeling at Eat First were going to be felt across the industry. And so we wanted to provide the kind of staff that these businesses might need. And then we realized that actually the scope for this platform is much wider than just delivery. And hospitality has the same problems, and construction and warehousing and event staffing and retail and so on. And so we've opened it up to basically cater to the whole hospitality sector, whether they need delivery people delivering food or people in the kitchen or people serving drinks. And
yeah, that's cool. So pretty fast. So what point did you get your first round of investment?
It was an unusual financing because when the idea came originally, actually, before Eat First, there was the idea of working on a platform that would deliver alcohol on demand. And I met with a friend of mine and we were talking about other models in the US that had been successful in delivering alcohol. And my friend's a bit of an investor. So he runs a property company and also invests in startups. And so he was like, let's explore this idea, and introduced me to some other investors. And while at Eat First and also talking to these other investors that had spent time in hospitality, we realized that actually my experience was like, well, let's not compete on delivering another good and service that everybody's trying to do in London. The main constraint, which from my experience, was actually supplying the staff. So let's be a supplier to all these businesses. And the investors bought on from the idea stage right in that meeting back while I was still running Eat First. And off the back of their interest, put together a business model, put together all the financials, etc., and then raised a £430,000 round. So they loved the idea. They knew that my experience was really relevant, and so and they wanted to have, you know, quite a large chunk of it of the business. And also, from my perspective, having been at Rocket, I know how important it is to start quickly and a big and move fast, especially when there's a big opportunity. And so I took the decision, which, you know, looking back, maybe was a bit too aggressive, but I took the decision to try and take on as much money as possible to kind of just start and accelerate.
Runway,
yeah. And exactly. And not worry about funding, you know, 6 months in, and kind of work for a year and a half and just trying to deliver a great product. In hindsight, it actually was probably a bit too much, because I ended up giving away a large chunk of the business, close to half, basically. And that serious constraints on my second fundraise.
Yeah, that's awkward. So that's really bit you now, you'd say, when you're trying to, because you can't really give away feasibly that much more.
Essentially, no new angel investor or even fund wants to invest in a company where the founder doesn't have a majority.
Yeah.
The later stage, obviously, financing you get, the more open investors are to invest where the founder has less or the management team have less. So the main constraint wasn't how much I was willing to give away, and maybe I was too generous with that. But it was actually that investors weren't motivated by the fact that already very early stage in the company,
I
had basically half of the company. The management team had slightly less than half.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's a really good model that you're able to start straight away with a big amount of capital, but it's like a win some, lose some.
I think there's no kind of correct way of getting a business off the ground, but I do think that the way that the tax breaks in the UK work have enabled businesses to give them some structure in terms of how they should raise. So SEIS is £150,000. That's probably your first raise, should be £150,000. Before you do an SEIS round, you probably scrounge together any money that you've saved and your co-founder saved, and you put together like £20,000 to start something. The next round will be an SEIS round. And then after that, you can do larger and larger rounds. But probably £150,000 at the beginning is the right size rather than 430.
Yeah. Okay, that's really interesting. So, working out rounds at the moment, when we want to be going for like a next round of funding, or if we need it, and how much to take. For the accelerator we're in, it's 120,000.
Okay.
But they only give you 20,000 initially, and then as long as you don't mess up, by the end of the 3 months, you get the other 100,000.
Okay. That sounds good. Like, that sounds like a pretty good scheme. Yeah. That's quite a lot of money. How much of the business do they take?
6%, which is also quite good.
So yeah.
Like, basically values it like 2 million.
Yeah.
Assuming you then get the rest of it.
That's pretty good. It's important, like, to be, it's important, you know, 6% for 120,000 is good. It's important also not to value the company too high.
Yes.
But no, I think that at the beginning, a company is kind of valued. It's kind of a bit random. It's a bit arbitrary. So if they were valuing the company at like 6 or 7 million, that would be a problem, because then once you need to fundraise again, you'll need to do a down round, which obviously if it's owned by an accelerator, I don't know what their perspective is on that. But if it's owned by other angels, they won't want to accept money at a lower valuation to which they invested. Yeah. The kind of rules of thumb for raising money, never give away more than 30% of your business at any fundraise. So ideally, you're giving away 20 to 25% every time you go for a fundraise. And in terms of valuation, it's usually a function of what your next major milestone is. So if the idea is to kind of reach a level of scale that allows you to be at least kind of break even in terms of your operating profit, how much money do you think you'll need to get to that level of scale? And if you shouldn't be giving away more than 25% of the business, then it's that amount times 4 is a valuation of your company. So that's a simple rule of thumb. Doesn't maybe work in every scenario. And maybe if your milestone is to deliver a certain level of technology that costs an X amount or needs an X amount of investment, how much is that? And the valuation is just a product of that.
Okay. So you've done a lot of scaling up businesses fairly rapidly in different parts of the world. What would you say is the most common challenge you've usually faced whilst doing that?
The most common challenge really comes around people. So setting up organizational structure and processes in a nutshell. So making sure that you know I think a big part of being a founder, especially when you want to scale a company, is understand what are the key roles that you need in the company and the key skills in order to roles to be executed well, and making sure that you have the right levers to motivate the people in those roles. So that's one part of it. And then another part of it, so the organizational structure, the accountability of how you're organized, etc. That's one part of it. And then the second part, I would say, is building processes, which are thinking about the future. So if you're a startup and you want to achieve X amount of market share, or you want to quadruple your revenue and your clients and your customers or your users over the next 6 months, what process do you need to have across different organizations, different departments in your organization that will still work at double the size, at triple the size, at triple the size? So that was a big thing about Rocket Internet, is they know that they're going to be growing very fast. And so they spend a lot of time on building processes that scale. So it obviously depends a little bit on the business model that you're in. And Rocket Internet has a lot of experience in very operational businesses. So e-commerce, food delivery, lots of different types of e-commerce platforms. But essentially, these are all businesses that have logistics, that have warehousing, that have account management roles, and therefore rely on very good processes. And I think that's pretty much true in every company. The processes are just different.
What have you done at BuzzHire to solve those problems?
That's a good question. I think the difficulty, I mean, the good thing about BuzzHire and for me was that obviously that this was not the first business that I started. And so I thought carefully about implementing processes from day one and documenting processes and understanding that essentially one thing that people soon realize when they start a business is that everything that they have in their mind about what they want to achieve, or in terms of financial targets, or also kind of type of clients they'll get on board, executing that plan is always harder than you expect. And so I always was quite conservative on what was needed to execute that plan. And so that helped me to be more realistic and not to kind of...
Yeah, have like fantasy style kind of, oh, we'll do this and it'll be amazing and then we'll get like another million.
Exactly. And sometimes when you are completely unrealistic, you get a big shock. Mm. Oh, we're going to do this and then next week we'll be ready to do that. And you start planning completely unrealistically. And then you look back 3 weeks later, you're not ready at all.
Yeah.
Because you were completely unrealistic about how you were planning and how much more difficult it was to execute something that you thought was easy. So I think that's what experience gives you. And so, yeah, building a good process is making sure that not just that you spend time to design it. If it's customer service, how do you respond to different issues that customers have? If you're it's a sales cycle, how do you approach clients? How do you sell to them? How do you track the performance? All these kind of processes. What you realize is that it's not just about designing the process and writing down on a piece of paper. Actually implementing a process is designing how things you think should be done, training it to someone, and that person maybe training it back to the other person so that they learn it, and then repeating it and tracking data from that. And this idea of kind of training and tracking sometimes gets overlooked. You design a process and then you think it's going to work, but then you don't adequately train someone, or you don't adequately track the right performance indicators.
Okay, cool. Then in terms of like scaling and hiring, what is your favorite interview question to get like the thing that you always look forward to when you're in an interview?
That's quite easy, because there's one question that I think my interview process really hasn't evolved at all in the last few years. So at Rocket, especially when I was in Africa, I probably interviewed in the space of 18 months close to 1,000 people. It sounds ridiculous, but we were hiring so much.
Yeah.
And if we hired 130 people, the company had 130 people when we left, probably over the course of time had 150 or 160 people. And for each slot, we probably had 10 people being interviewed or more. So I did a lot of interviews and I spent a lot of my time doing HR. But since then, my questions that I ask haven't evolved that much. What's changed is how quick I am to make a decision. So it's really, unfortunately, I try to wait a bit longer, but it's usually about a minute before I've made a decision on someone. And the rest is just trying to kind of fill the time and validate what I thought.
But so I remember when you interviewed me, it actually took quite a long time. And I was kind of surprised, but I really liked the interview. I thought it felt like I learned a lot from it. And yeah, it felt kind of quite valuable, the whole experience, even though.
Yeah,
we had decided for Saturday.
Yeah, I remember we did take a long time. And whenever we take a long time, that's always because I've decided straight away that I would like to hire the person. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the rest is kind of...
more establishing that it's going to be right for them.
Yeah.
In their mind.
Exactly. It's more of a sale process.
Yeah, it did feel more like kind of like... it just felt really nice, like learning more. Like, I didn't expect to have so much chance to learn about BuzzHire than that I got from the interview. And it was like, oh, that's really useful because it's all the things I kind of want to know. But
yeah. No, exactly. If the interview goes bad, it usually lasts about 15 minutes. Mm. But if the interview goes well, then it'll last like an hour and a half. And that's just, it's worth the investment because you think this, out of the people that I've met, this is the kind of person that I'd like to hire. So going back to your question, though, on what are the interesting things that I like to ask? I generally, depending on the role, but there's one kind of brain teaser that I've always asked. And I was asked this for my first ever interview when I was 19. I interviewed to work at Lehman Brothers. That doesn't exist anymore. And out of all the interview questions they asked me, this one was the one that I enjoyed the most. I wasn't ready for that interview at all, being only 19, not even understanding what an investment bank was, essentially. And they asked me how many roses were sold in London on Valentine's Day. And so now I ask that. And a lot of people have said to me, what are you trying to get out of that? Because how does that relate to what they need to be doing and so on? But I think over time, what I realized is that I like that question a lot because the answer will show me a lot about how they think. And I want them to be detailed enough to be accurate, but not too detailed that they get stuck up on the question and take forever to answer it. I want there to be kind of a structured logic to how they approach a problem. And it's an easy question in my perspective. It's not a hugely complicated brain teaser. And therefore, there's never going to be anybody that won't be able to give it a try. But I've seen what a fantastic answer can be. And so I like to ask questions which are not too difficult, but the range of possible answers is very high. And so that's a brain teaser that I always ask. And then the other question is really to understand how they would describe themselves in general. That's usually the first question I ever ask is, what words would you use to describe yourself? And things that I don't like to hear are their work experience as one of the ways that they describe themselves. I'd like to hear actual adjectives about who they are so that I understand not really just about what this person's strengths are, but does he fit into the organization?
Yeah.
Or she fit in the organization?
How many roses are sold in London on Valentine's Day?
I have no idea. I actually have no idea. I did at one point look it up because I thought I'm asking this question so many times that I should probably know. And it was really quite difficult to find the answer. I think I found, if I remember correctly, that in the UK, or in England, sorry, not the UK, 25 million were sold back in 2011 or so. And there's little tips and tricks to the answering that I like. Mm. So bonus points will go to people that not just look at the demand side, but also look at the supply side. So a lot of people estimate the population of London and then think about how many women there are, men there are, and couples and so on. And that's the demand side. And that's always a good way to start. But then some other people then validate that answer by trying to think, okay, how many zones are there in London and how many shops could be selling it? And does that actually make any sense in terms of that number? That's a bonus point. Another bonus point would be to talk about the businesses that also in the events that we're also buying roses on Valentine's Day, not just the people that are in couples.
Yeah. And how many people get married on Valentine's Day?
Yeah, no idea. That's probably a harder one to estimate.
And can you describe yourself in adjectives? Because when we started, you definitely gave me a list of your work experience. And...
no, in terms of my personality, I think ambitious. I'm very rational and pragmatic. And interpersonal in terms of sociable. I like getting along with lots of different people from different backgrounds. So I think that's my background. I'm international. My family's Italian. I lived in the US. I lived in London. I obviously traveled to Asia and Africa. So that explains why I like getting along with lots of different types of people with different cultures. And that's also reflected in the staff at BuzzHire. It's very international. But yeah, as an entrepreneur, I'm very kind of pragmatic and ambitious.
I remember you telling me a story about you served an olive oil business when
you
were younger.
Yeah.
And I remember that being really cool. And I kind of like to hear more about that.
Yeah. So actually, one of the entrepreneurial things that I did growing up was this olive oil business. I forgot to mention. But basically, I knew when I left uni that I wasn't ready to start working. And I didn't like the idea of just jumping into what everybody else was doing. I didn't have a clear idea of what I wanted to do. I had done an internship at a hedge fund the year before, but I didn't feel satisfied by the role. I was doing equity research and I felt like I was researching something and selling my analysis in order for people to buy stock. And that didn't really kind of gratify me. So I took a year out, and luckily my parents had just bought a house in Tuscany. They'd all left from London and bought a place in Tuscany, and they had some olive oil, olive groves, but we were not doing anything with olive oil. So I thought that was a cool project to kick off. So I basically spoke to the family and asked them to, we produced about 1,000 liters of oil. And in the meantime, I made the packaging. I bought the equipment that's needed to package it into bottles. I rented a van. I actually went over to Italy first, got a sample, brought it back to London, and went around to lots of delicatessens around London, showing them the sample and having them taste it and get orders in. I learned the difficulty of planning versus execution. I thought, okay, I'm going to give around 20 samples and I'll get orders for 1,000 liters. Instead, I got orders for like 20 liters of oil, and I produced 1,000. But I rented this van, went over to Italy, and spent pretty much a week bottling in a kind of a hut in Tuscany, 2,000 bottles, because each bottle was half a liter. Loaded it up in a van with a mate of mine who just came around for the ride. He also got paid in a few bottles of olive oil. And yeah, ship drove back. I also learned the impact of FX, because I was buying the olive oil in euros and obviously selling it in pounds. And over the 6-7 months that I was working on this, the euro had strengthened massively versus the pound, making it so much more expensive to sell. And I also learned consignment. So at the beginning, I was really struggling. I had 20 liters sold in advance, and I was trying to sell 980 liters, and very few people agreed to buy it off me. And so I learned what was consignment. So I would drop off a box of 12 bottles and tell them that I'd be back in a month to see how many were sold. And all of a sudden, I got my boxes in all the delis around London, and all of a sudden they were starting to sell and I was starting to make money. And that way there was no risk from the seller's side. And I was actually starting to ship a lot of this oil and reducing my storage costs, because something that I didn't kind of evaluate was the huge cost of storing 1,000 liters in London, in central London. So it was a really fun experience. And that's actually why I decided to join Procter & Gamble in the end, because I was like, I need to be selling a product. I need to be dealing with something that's much more tangible than a piece of share price or something. So I did that over the period of about 7-8 months, and then went traveling, and then managed to sell pretty much 95% of everything that I shipped over.
That's pretty impressive. But yeah, that's mental. Do you think if you were that age now doing the same thing, you would try doing it on Fulfilled by Amazon?
Yeah, I guess there's so much more that you can do online these days. I guess that was 10 years ago. So, or a bit less actually, 8 years ago. And yeah, I don't know if olive oil sells on Amazon, but I imagine it does. Mm. But I imagine there's a lot of online platforms nowadays to buy olive oil. Actually, back then, olive oil was really not a huge kind of product in the UK at all. You'd go to the local deli and there'd be one bottle of olive oil at a standard price, and it'd probably be priced at £7-8. So that market in itself has completely changed in the UK. The pricing of olive oil can be even more expensive than wine, and the selection can be almost the same. And so I think now there are tons of different websites, and Fulfilled by Amazon potentially makes it much easier to sell the product than doing it, the whole thing that I did. But there is a bit of a beauty in kind of
doing it all yourself,
and you learn so much more.
Yeah, I think the first time I do anything in business, I like to do it all myself and then work out like what I can automate and work. Like, so for the podcast, like I'm doing everything completely myself, and then like just processing everything and then working out what I can like put onto Upwork and like get automated and things.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that quality is really important in starting a business, because startups have become a very sexy thing to do. And a lot of people that really don't understand what it means to start a business end up trying to do it, but they don't like getting their hands dirty. Mm. And you've got to love that process. You've got to love that idea of like trying and being involved in every single part of the process. And then exactly like you said, understanding what skills you need or what resources you need to be able to do that more scalably.
I was going to ask, what's like the one quality you've noticed with most of successful founders? Do you think that would be your answer then?
No, I think the main quality, I mean, it's been talked about a lot. A lot of people talk about it. I think there's two main things is really ambition and determination. And actually, there's one TED talk that I really like from this ex-McKinsey woman who became a psychologist, and she talks about the importance of grit. Mm. And basically, that's the combination of ambition and perseverance. And I think if you have those, then you go a long way to being successful. And that's what I've seen from a lot of other founders. At Rocket Internet, whenever you talk to Oliver Samwell, who's in charge of Rocket Internet, you can feel that his ambition is absolutely massive. Mm. And the determination is, you can feel it when you talk to him and every second of what he says. And also, he also has an insane energy. So I guess when you're extremely determined and very ambitious, the energy is kind of a natural byproduct of that.
Okay, cool. I also found being able to use mentors quite useful. What would you say has been the best advice you've been given by any mentors?
I've had so much advice and events have come from so many different places. It's hard to say like what's the one best thing. And
sometimes it might be like just the right thing at the right time.
Exactly.
Maybe it's irrelevant.
Exactly. I think that's really important. The right thing at the right time. One conversation with one person might completely change the direction in which you go just because it resonates at that moment in time. And it's so amazing, I think, how just, especially when you're starting a business, even one simple sentence can change your world. I think if I try and think of really good advice that I've had to kind of give some anecdotes, it's not a mentor. There was a book I read which had some nice advice and is completely unexpected. A book about a football manager, so not even anything to do with tech, but he's well known for managing people. And I think obviously being able to manage people well is super important in building a successful business. And one thing was, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And what the point of that is, in order to get the best out of people, you need to show them that you care in their development. And I think that's very relevant nowadays, and it's very relevant nowadays in a country like the UK with millennials and so on. This old kind of management strategy of I'm the boss, you do what I tell you, doesn't motivate people. And so I've kind of seen that you need to empathize with other people and understand and help them and train them in order to get the best out of them. And so I think that was something nice that I read. It's also easy to remember.
Yeah, I really like it.
Yeah, and I think people, your work, you'll enjoy your work and you'll work hard if you believe in the vision and you trust your manager. And yeah, if you don't think that your manager gives a shit about you, then you'll never be able to motivate people.
Okay. As a non-technical founder, what advice do you have for people trying to start a tech business?
Learn tech. I don't know. So, well, I think that the two most important functions in building a tech business, a CTO, obviously, and someone who can fundraise. So actually having it separate makes sense. I mean, ideally, if it's not a pure tech play and there's an operational part of it, you have a CTO, a COO, and a CEO. And that's how we're set up at BuzzHire. So it's just, if there's someone dedicated on managing the tech and you're non-tech, you'll need to decide who's responsible for fundraising and who's responsible for running the business. And that really should be two different people. Trying to run the business and fundraise is probably not going to work.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense from the experiences that I've seen. That would have helped a lot of.
Yeah. Actually, that was a really big learning for me, basically, that I'd always at Rocket Internet ran a lot of businesses and I really enjoyed that and working with teams and managing teams and setting targets and talking about the vision. And then very quickly, I BuzzHire, where there wasn't a central fundraising function, the CEO, the founder, I had to be responsible for getting the investment in. I very quickly had to learn how to fundraise, which is a whole different area of expertise in itself. And drag myself away from being involved in the business. And actually, they're completely different types of work. And the more you're involved you are in the day-to-day of the business, the more likely it's going to be difficult for you to sell the vision of the 3 or 4 or 5 year vision that investors want to hear. So that really needs to be two separate people.
Cool. That's not advice I've ever heard, but it's actually really useful. Makes sense. So I set up at Automorph as CTO, CEO, COO. So, because I haven't really defined like who's going to be doing fundraising exactly and who's going to be running stuff. But that's definitely useful food for thought of how we're going to do these things.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what also people enjoy. I mean, to be honest, it's completely different. You know, running the business on a day-to-day level, you see incremental progress being made. Whereas fundraising, you can spend 6 months or 4 months talking to investors and might not get anywhere. And that can be quite demotivating. And you need to be a bit of a salesperson. But you obviously need to understand the business inside out as you do that. But I remember my first fundraise, the initial feedback that I got, not when I launched with the 430,000, but the second one where we got in 750. It took a lot longer than we anticipated. And a big part of the feedback at the beginning was, you're too involved in the business at the moment. And therefore, you're not spending enough time to sell me the vision of where you're going to be in 5 years and where you're going to be in 6 years. And you're talking a little bit too much about the constraints that you have today and how you're going to solve today's constraints and not how you're going to solve the big problem of tomorrow for multiple markets. And it's very hard to be able to sell that really well if you're still involved in dealing with like the very nitty gritty detail of everyday business. So I've become better at it to the point now that I've raised a small round just now, £200,000. And basically, I never completely stepped away from the business. But I think as the business grows and the amount your fundraising grows, it's very difficult to manage two at the same time.
Okay. Can we just backtrack to what was the name of the book?
Oh, so it's the manager is called Carlo Ancelotti, who's an Italian film manager, one of the most successful. I'm obviously Italian, I'm a big football fan, so I'm slightly embarrassed that I bought that book, but actually it's very relevant. And I think it's something to do like the art of management. Oh no, the quiet leadership. So basically he was one of the most successful managers in football history. And unlike most other managers in football history, he's extremely peaceful and quiet in his demeanor and very calm. And so that's quite rare. Most times you see successful managers shouting at people. And so the whole book really talks through, it's a business book essentially, about how to get the best out of the people working with you.
Okay, cool. Then on a completely different track, if I let you keep all of your memories, but I'm going to put your mind back in your body of like when you're first born, what one thing in your life would you definitely not do, assuming like the effects of like meeting people and wives and stuff would still happen the same?
What would I definitely not do? Interesting. I'm really, it's a difficult one to answer, to be honest, because I'm really quite happy with where I am. And so I feel like everything that I've done has got me to this position.
Mm.
I think it's very hard to say. There's nothing really that I regret.
Okay, you know, like a major sporting accident where you're like, oh, I wish I could still like...
Okay, I thought more on a career basis, but I can already tell if that, especially in the last kind of 4 or 5 years, it's the concept of having balance. Mm-hmm. So if I could kind of, I wouldn't have to go back to being a baby. I'd probably have to go back kind of 4 or 5 years ago, where I kind of started the startup roller coaster and never ended. And I think it's almost impossible. And you kind of have to live that kind of working crazy hours, having a lot of pressure to get to a point that you realize that you don't need to have so much pressure on yourself. But if I could go through it again, I think I would try to have a bit more balance in my life. So, you know, make an effort to do sport, make an effort to kind of have a hobby. It's a difficult one because it takes so much effort and energy to get a business off the ground. And you've got to be willing to put that energy in. But you've also got to have a clear idea of when you can say no and when you...
Yeah.
And in order to get the best out of yourself. And sometimes, I think, over the last few years, you put too much pressure on yourself. People forget that, you know, their careers should last a span over kind of 50 years.
Mm.
And you do need to put a lot of energy and effort into something, but you don't need to put so much pressure on success this second.
Yeah, sure.
So I think, if I could go back 5 or 6 years, I probably wouldn't have to change anything. I would have all that knowledge already and not get so stressed about everything that was potentially going wrong for the first time.
Okay, it's like almost more of a mindset.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Is there any one thing that you absolutely would do? Like any sort of, could be like, I walk Machu Picchu, I defined my life or something.
I really loved my year out where I built the Audible business and then I took 6-7 months out traveling. I love traveling. I love understanding different things and talking to different people and different cultures. And it has completely shaped the way I live today and the realm of possibility that I see in my life. That has some negatives as well, because sometimes too much choice or the idea of choice can actually give you kind of, you can get all...
You can be a bit swamped with like possibilities sometimes.
Exactly. And so that's the negative of feeling like, well, actually, I could live in South America and I could do this and I could do that. And that's one of the negatives maybe that I got from being able to spend 8 months traveling the world. But a lot of positives, and I think I would definitely think, I'm definitely glad I did that. I'm definitely glad I took a year out, didn't jump into the career, didn't get my mind focused on a specific area that I wasn't sure about, and spent time to take time out. And every time I moved from business to business within Rocket, I usually took about 4 or 5 months to go traveling. And it just helps you to kind of take a step back and get some perspective on what you want to do next. It's important to do that, especially nowadays where everything is moving so fast. Everyone thinks, okay, I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to do this. And being able to kind of step back and take some perspective will probably help you make a better decision on what's next for you.
Cool. Thanks a lot. One item, if your house was to catch fire, would you rescue? Pets aside and family. Motorbike counts even if it's not in your house.
I think it is the motorbike.
Yeah.
It's got to be the motorbike. I actually don't have that many possessions apart from my motorbike. Really bare minimum. I was going to say my mobile phone, but actually I lost my mobile phone last week. And the 2 days that I was without it was bliss. So, and you can completely survive without it and it's not an issue. And actually I can think for the first time in kind of months. So that would be kind of a godsend. But yeah, my motorbike, I like being independent. That's maybe one of the main things I enjoy in life. And that's also why I'm a founder. And yeah, my motorbike is a huge part of that.
Cool. So you like, do you feel awkward if you haven't been on your motorbike in a week or something? You're just like, I just need to go outside. And
I hate the idea that I'm in kind of not in control and therefore kind of commuting to work and relying on the tube and also... or not working, or and also the concept of thousands of people hurting themselves to their office every morning, that really kind of demotivates me. And
I feel really like insignificant. Like, I got the team, I'm like, oh, I hate my life. And sometimes I'll see people that look like my friends that aren't my friends, like, oh, there's so many people just like everyone I already know. Like,
yeah,
it just feels like so tiny in the world. It's kind of a bit defeating.
I agree. I felt like sometimes in the morning, if you're on like a really packed train and everyone's going, it's like, we're just people, you know, we go to work every day, we do some work, we go home, we sleep, we eat. It's like, it doesn't feel like creative or stimulating. Yeah. So it's actually one of the reasons I remember very specifically that I was working at Procter & Gamble and I wanted to do something more entrepreneurial. And I loved the company and I loved the people there and what I was doing. But I just remember taking the commute from Clapham Junction every day and waiting with like crowds and crowds of people in the cold and just thinking like, I've got to be doing something where it doesn't feel like I'm just clocking in and clocking out.
Yeah.
And actually, sometimes it's just the mode of transport that you take to go to work. I actually read, someone told me about a book written by some behavioral economists where they said you get the most incremental satisfaction in life by your commute. It's, you know, not money or kind of quality of life or whatever. It's specifically the one way that you can improve your quality of life the most is changing your commute. So that's a big reason why I'm on a bike.
Yeah, same for me on a bicycle. Like, I just like commuting by bicycle. It's sort of half an hour to an hour a day of biking. It's fine. I can listen to something interesting and have some time. Now I've done some exercise at least, and it's good.
Yeah, and you decide when you get on it. You decide when you get off. You decide which route you take. I'm with you on that.
Okay, cool. I think that was it, really. Any major questions you want to ask me?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to just... hear the way that you've got to where you've got to now. Like, how did you come up with this business, or how did it come about?
So this business actually is through a friend that I met at my choir.
Okay.
Interestingly. And we went to a few festivals together performing and kind of got to know each other and kind of basically bonded over, like, I don't know, doing software and being more entrepreneurial, really, because he was running a marketing business at the time.
Okay.
And then he had this idea for doing also more of like the software development like a year ago.
Okay.
And we worked on it for a bit, but then he went off traveling and I got more into software development and then became a coder and worked for you. Then I left in April, and end of April I started my own development agency and I basically started building apps and kind of worked nomadically for a month just building apps, which is cool. And then when I came back, he came back at the same time and was actually put his shit together with the business of what we're now doing and was ready to like take it to the next level. So he got back in touch with me being like, okay, I've finally worked out how the hell to do this. I've found myself, I've written this programming language that actually allows us to do these things.
Okay.
And so we started like working on it a bit more full time and putting things together and applying to accelerators and working out some pilot projects with stuff. And so, yeah, kind of just right people at the right time, I guess.
Okay. And so it's two of you or?
So it was us two, and now we've been joined by another of one of his friends who's who's going to take over the role of CTO as Frederick moves into more CEO stuff as things progress. But for now, like, he's coding most of the core of it.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, that's how it kind of came to be, I guess.
Yeah, it's always fairly fortuitously people that you meet, friends that you know.
Yeah, so I think part of the like actually spending hobbies, I meet loads of people doing things, and or like when I you know, I had like that week away in Bulgaria where I went skiing, I met a guy who I ended up sort of couch surfing with, who was like a coder, and he ended up being like my first hire for the development agency that I started in April, and we went to Greece together. And so like actually kind of doing things that aren't so much like work, you end up actually being able to sort of sometimes make more sales or do other things that you didn't think you could do.
Yeah.
You kind of have more fun doing it. You're actually not always cutting yourself off. And so I've started doing loads of climbing and skateboarding and rollerblading now, but I'm still kind of meeting people that are doing things that are useful. And it's sort of like, okay, I get like headspace, but I just, wherever I am, I kind of meet the people that are more like me that I want to talk to, and people that aren't, okay, it doesn't matter. But
No, I agree. I mean, I think... Yeah, making like just doing hobbies and getting out of your comfort zone or just doing something different, you never know what's going to come out of it. And if you kind of get into that mode of constantly doing different things, then just over time, a lot of good things will happen.
Yeah, because like the traditional networking of just going to all like the startup events is like a surefire way to do it, but it's hard if that's all you do every day and like gets a bit soul destroying. When actually you can be going having fun and going rollerblading most evenings or things, and actually stuff still kind of happens and you meet people and
And probably make better interactions, like more fulfilling interactions because you're both doing.
Yeah, you might like to go and hold it with someone and actually like be like, okay, this is really cool. I could definitely work with you like a full time rather than just sort of like the like salesy orientated side of things, transaction orientated.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. That's cool. Well, good luck.
Thanks. Yeah, and where do we follow you? So BuzzHire would be at BuzzHire UK or something on Twitter?
On Twitter, it's just at BuzzHire. And on Facebook, it's /BuzzHire-UK.
So if anybody wants a job in catering or...
Want to follow our journey, we're also on Instagram, just searching BuzzHire. If you want to work in catering or have flexible work around London, give us a contact us. Either through Facebook or Instagram, but also just to follow how we're doing and how things are going.
And then if anyone wants to follow you on Twitter, is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what my Twitter handle is.
Okay, I'll find that.
Yeah, I think it's at Nick-Miller, but I imagine as my name is pretty common, there's probably...
Even the Sam Harris podcast.
Yeah.
As well. It's really cool.
Yeah, that's a bit of an issue. But yeah, I'm actually not super active on Twitter, but I'm planning to be more active.
Yeah. Okay.
So
if people contact you, hopefully you'll. But I definitely get all the stuff. I'm pretty inactive on Twitter, but when people send me a message or something, I'll see it in my notifications.
I think actually as a founder, you should be building your brand in some way. It's kind of part of the role. So I've neglected it over the last couple of years, but it's something that I've intended. I actually started a blog and I'd like to continue that. So just got one post for now, but hopefully it'll be doubling and tripling that over the coming weeks.
Maybe like a monthly thing.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. Thanks very much. Yeah. Been really nice interviewing you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been very fun.
Right. So that was Nick Miller. What a fascinating conversation. Woo! As a roundup, I have my key takeaways, as always. 1. Don't give away too much of your company. Getting more money always seems like a good idea, but ask yourself if you really need it all straight away, or if you can do without and retain a bigger holding and thus more control of your company. VCs are often put off by companies where the founders don't have a controlling share in the company, so you don't want to risk that. But on the flip side, don't be too greedy. Trying to retain like 100% or like 95% and only giving away a small amount for like a crazy valuation is also really stupid. Like, it's better to have £500,000 business than it is to have 95% of nothing. I'd never really thought of giving away anywhere near the kind of percentages that Nick then mentions, and was pretty amazed that you could even do that, and was like, oh crap, I guess you could just start a business much more quickly and efficiently if you just give away more of it. So yeah, don't be greedy and don't be too generous. Try and find the right balance in the middle. 2, plan your living and working situation in a way that you can enjoy your commute. Commutes are one of the single biggest contributors to well-being and happiness, much more than most material items. And it's been proven that it can actually make the biggest difference in your overall happiness beyond like having a really nice house and other things that you work really hard for. So yeah, enjoy your commute. And before taking on a job that pays higher, ask yourself if the commute will make you happy rather than the money. 3, try to ask oddball questions during an interview to gauge more personality. If you think the person's worthwhile, spend time in the interview to make sure they really understand the business and that they have everything that they need to make the decision to work with you. And if you gauge them early on as probably not being the right fit, just can the interview as quickly as possible and don't waste time. Okay, so those are some pretty logical and sensible takeaways that I made as notes after the interview. But actually listening back to this podcast, in terms of the information that I needed to keep hold of for starting my company, I didn't really need any of those things straight away, as I haven't yet decided on investment plans or had any real commute or done any interviewing yet, and it's now 6 months later. But some of the other things he alluded to that I perhaps felt I already knew really well and already learned before, I've actually been completely messing up on. And it's quite funny that often you just need to make the same mistakes and relearn some lessons the hard way to really get it. So in the 6 months since recording this podcast, listening back, it genuinely feels like he was telling me so much more and I just wasn't listening. And the key insights that I should have taken were to have clear distinctions on the roles of the founders. So someone to raise money and drive the vision, your CEO. Someone to run the business and keep things together, your COO. And someone to build the tech, your CTO. And then you can just stop getting in each other's way and just really work together as a team rather than crossing over each other's paths. But boy, did I think we already had this sorted. We even named ourselves CEO, CTO, and COO. But sadly, our CEO was not as ready for the split as we thought. And realistically, it was mostly him trying to do everything and not giving us space to really do anything. I should have noticed up front the problem and been a lot more forceful about this, or just recognized that if the CEO isn't ready to take on other members of the team, then there's no point being part of the business until it's matured further and needs more people. And yeah, totally didn't do that. So secondly, give yourself time and space. Expect all of your plans to take twice as long, or even more than twice as long, at least. And ensure that you just take on the minimal amount of stuff at any point in time so that you just do it properly. Then you won't get stressed out, you'll deliver what you say you're going to do, and it'll be good.
Again, at my last startup, we were relentlessly taking on more and more things,
creating so much overhead work, and we're just talking and planning all these different things that it actually became impossible to even do any of them. In hindsight, the signs were pretty clearly on the wall when I joined the company, but I maybe didn't take them seriously enough, and it led to a lot of stress. And even now, I'm still often being a stupid human being and taking on multiple things when I could be focusing on just getting more stuff done properly and not spreading myself so thin. So yeah, give yourself time to focus on just being awesome at minimal stuff instead of being kind of shit at everything. Really good tip. Moving on to books. Yay. So Nick recommends The Quiet Leadership, Winning Hearts, Minds and Matches, a book by Carlo Ancelotti. It's a thoughtful insight into managing people and getting buy-in from others, and also into the world of football. It sounds like a really good read, and I'm happy to add it to my ever-growing list of books. Nick mentions a great quote, "People don't care how much you know till they know how much you care," which is a really nice insight on how much of a role passion plays when you want to be successful at anything, really. Okay, if you want to get in touch with Nick or find out about BuzzHire, you can reach out on Twitter to NickAM30 on Twitter, or just BuzzHire on Twitter. And you can view their website, www.buzzhire.co, that is .co and not .com, to see what they're up to. Or if you're interested in a convenient temp job in London, or you're looking for staff, then you can reach me at SamHarrisTweets on Twitter or at SamJamSnaps on Instagram.
As always, thanks a lot for listening. If you found the podcast useful, please support me by rating the podcast in iTunes or your preferred app. Please become a subscriber and share your favorite podcast with others, as it really helps me grow the podcast. I'm Sam, and this has been another episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. I hope you enjoy your day.